Welcome, listeners. You've been spared the agony of the last 40 minutes while we were all trying to...
My fault. I'm sorry.
Trying to get all sorts of recorded stuff to work and get Graham's... Graham had to reboot his BIOS to record this podcast. So let's... Like, I'm sure Keats would have had something to say about this, about the fleeting beauty and how, you know, the Jesus, the sinner that repents is worth more than something or other. I'm not sure, but I do know that this is Linux Voice Podcast at Season 4, Episode 15, and I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham
Morrison.
I'm
Ben Everard.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And we have the, basically now, formulaic and derivative news. That other thing, the discoveries, we have a halfway reminder still to come. We may or may not have Voice of the Neurons. And Voice of the Neurons? Vocalise your neurons.
You what?
And the last thing we have is we're throwing tradition out of the window. We have defenestrated the old and fusty ways of doing things. We don't have a voice of the masses. Instead, we have a voice of the minority, which is just us talking about some stuff. If you like the sound of that, you can subscribe to more in the shape of a magazine, which is called Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com. And that comes in both paper and electronic formats, neither of which have any DRM. Right, sounds like it's time for news.
For the news, right. First up on the news this fortnight, I could have linked so much better than this because our very first news item is about DRM.
Oh. That's not bad. That's not bad.
But all I can do.
Well, it's late and I've not had my dinner, so let's just not go back and do it again. Let's just carry on.
Let's push on. To listeners, just imagine I made a clever link about DRM at this point, and which is now in Firefox, so you can watch Netflix and Amazon videos, maybe, and some other things on Firefox and Linux without installing plugins, thanks to the Widevine plugin, Widevine content decryption module. Sorry, not plugin at all. So this is either fantastic news or awful news, depending on whether you're a Netflix viewer or a privacy advocate.
You can be both.
Is this shipped and enabled by default in the latest Firefox releases?
It's shipped. I'm not sure it's enabled. And it's in Firefox 49.
Right. Okay. Because, I mean, they've been talking about this for a while, haven't they? I remember, I think we discussed it a while back when it was first announced. And I think Tim Berners-Lee came out recently and said he was trying to, delay adoption of this one way or the other. I mean, you know, if people want to install proprietary plugins and things for their browsers to watch their proprietary closed media sources, then I guess that's up to them. But I can understand that a lot of us are wary of the web eventually being closed up into this, you know, under this umbrella of non-sharing and non-copying.
Yeah, I do. I find it quite difficult on myself because on the one hand, I think the ship of video DRM on the web has sailed. It doesn't matter whether or not you want it. It's there. It's staying there. It's not going anywhere. Whether it's Silverlight, whether it's Flash, whether it's HTML5 plugins, it doesn't really matter. There is going to be DRM on video on the web. That's yeah. The long and the short of it. It becomes much trickier then when you sort of see the next step beyond that, because I mean, there's people trying to push DRM in text on the web, so you can't just copy and paste and whatnot, and into images, so you have to have all sorts of proprietary stuff installed just to be able to view images on the web. And I think that is a step too far.
I'm still skeptical about a lot of these things, just the technology behind them. Like, you know, a text where you just need to take a screenshot and use OCR software. All text on the web, if you've got a good monitor, is sufficiently high quality, an OCR program be able to take it. As a kid, we had 3.5mm to 3.5mm jack cables. You could just record anything off the radio or one machine to another. It's impossible to stop this.
It's true, but there's a big difference between having to highlight something and right-click copy then hang on, sit there while I take 10 screenshots, paste them together and run an OCR on it.
Yeah.
And someone will automate it. But
I mean, you get Firefox extensions that take an entire screenshot of the whole page in one, so you don't have to scroll, print screen, paste in the GIMP and stuff.
You don't need to make things impossible. Just make them hard.
Yeah, you have those extensions now, but will they work with DRM? Don't forget Firefox now has to sign extensions that you install. Or Mozilla has to sign extensions.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think there's reason to be wary. I just think it's, you know, there are better ways to deal with it than this cat and mouse game, when ultimately it will still be possible to copy things. Make good content that people want to pay for.
I think, as we said before, I think it does set a bad precedent. And I think, you know, DRM and things like this is actually how content creators, if that's what they like to be called, want the way the world to be in 10 years or 15 years time. I think that's the real threat, that you bring up a generation who doesn't know anything better than the fact that everything's protected, that an iPhone, for example, comes with a proprietary connector to a proprietary set of headphones that will only play stuff that you've licensed off a certain content provider. They don't care about us who can OCR a few screens and get around it. And the web needs to be free.
Yeah, but you know, what goes around comes around. Think back to the early 1980s when, you know, all computer hardware was so proprietary and lumped in with its own operating system. And then a certain company came along called Microsoft, who had the idea of, you know, being able to sell its operating system across multiple hardware platforms. So, while obviously many of us are not the biggest Microsoft fans, that was something they did to get a standard hardware platform, to encourage a standard hardware platform. Okay, that's a long time ago in one particular set of circumstances, but these things tend to have a way of working themselves out, I reckon.
Okay, next up in the news this fortnight, a step towards more freedom with Fedora now running on RISC-V. This is the, how to describe it, it's the open hardware, it's the open instruction set with several open hardware implementations, which is basically allows you to have an open source CPU in the heart of your computer. And now Fedora will run on it.
That's incredible. That's amazing.
Yeah. At the moment, this is really, well, basically it only really works in QEMU. So you can sort of virtualize it. But there are, there's the Rocket Cores, which developed by University of Berkeley, I think, that you can put on to FPGAs if you've got appropriate hardware. Or there's Low Risk, who are actually looking at creating actual CPUs that will be able to run Fedora in the not too distant future. And then, we'll be a lot closer to a fully open computer. And there's still going to be proprietary bits in memory and network and drives and stuff for the moment, but this is a huge step closer.
So I assume that none of us are going to be rocking these things on our high-end desktops and laptops anytime soon, but is there scope or any possibility soon of a single-board computer, like Raspberry Pi thing, using a fully open chip?
Fully open is a big word.
Okay.
It's going to be significantly more open. There's a long way to go before you're fully open. There's a huge amount, really. The CPU is only a little bit of your entire computer. And the Low Risk is more of a system on a chip, but it's still got some proprietary bits in it. And it's going to be a long, long time before they can get down to Raspberry Pi sort of prices, just because of the volumes of scale and that sort of thing. It's realistically, it may not be more than a few years away to you can get a... This thing, if you really want to, you can probably get an FPGA running fairly well. Probably now, I think I was going to say Low Risk, Open Risk will run Debian, and that will burn onto an FPGA. But it's not an easy thing to do, and you don't have a very powerful computer at the end of it.
Yeah, I remember speaking to the Open Risk guys at. Here in Munich, they came and visited. They had a meetup a couple of years ago, and I think we spoke to them at Fosdem once, didn't we? Or one of them, Alex Bradbury, or somebody. Or
That's Low Risk.
Low Risk, okay, but it's related, isn't it? So
they're similar. So Low Risk is based on the RISC-V implementation, and it's a much more modern open set. Open Risk is I can't remember which instruction set it's based on, but it's a more established but older architecture.
I heard Alex Bradbury wrote a book and he got some guy to help him with like typos and stuff.
Yeah, Alex Bradbury is my co-author on Learning Python for the Raspberry
Pi. Learning Python for the Raspberry Pi by Alex Bradbury, everybody. Go and find it on Amazon.
He's so cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge step forward because, you know, we think about running open source, blah, blah, blah. But actually, if you sort of look at it, you know, almost all CPUs these days run some proprietary, essentially a proprietary OS that runs below your main OS, the Intel Management Engine, they call it, and there's another one for AMDs, which I forget the name of. So even if you think you're running open software, you're actually running open software emulated proprietary piece of hardware. So I think this is a huge step forward. And
it's good to have, even if, like I say, we won't be using all this stuff on our desktops and our laptops anytime soon. It's good to know it's there, and respect to the people working on it.
Yeah, it's there and it's growing. This is a huge, well, it's still a fairly small movement, but it's huge compared to where it was sort of 5 years ago. And that was huge compared to where it was 5 years before that. Right, let's move on with the next item of news, and that is that Julian Assange has had his internet cut. I know exactly how he feels, because my internet was cut 2 minutes before we were due to record this podcast, but that appears to be to the ineptitude of Sky rather than the Ecuadorian embassy, although I can't be sure.
Poor Julian Assange, I feel such sympathy for him. What a lovely man. What a nice man.
Yeah.
He's done nothing wrong. He's not a sex offender by any measure. And yet he's kept against his will imprisoned in the Ecuadorian embassy. Poor lad.
He just wanted to make the internet great again. Don't we all?
Ah, oh, dear.
There must be really very little to do by now in the Ecuadorian embassy without the internet.
You would hope that the cuisine should be good. I mean, ceviche and all that stuff. You know, if there's nothing else to do, I'd just get really buff, really ripped. Someone should ask him what he squats now. You know, hey Assange, you've just been confined indoors for the last 3 years. What's your max deadlift?
Maybe he's recreated the Ecuadorian embassy in Minecraft. That's what I would do if I sat in a building for a lot of the day, which of course I do writing about Linux.
These WikiLeaks people, they've released a lot of stuff about Hillary Clinton being bad, haven't they?
Yeah, yes. Transcripts of her speeches and whatnot.
And their emails.
Have they released anything about Trump being bad?
I don't think that's a leak.
No, but I mean, there is stuff to leak, though, isn't there? Like, one assumes.
Yeah, WikiLeaks is essentially a publishing platform. If they had data, I'm sure they would release it. I don't know. The timing
is a little bit suspect.
Yeah.
Well, they've always been fairly political with their timing.
But political, you know, in what sort of obstreperous spanner in the works sort of politics, pardon me.
Yeah, trying to raise their own profile.
Yeah. I'm surprised that somebody can't just set up I'm surprised, firstly, that he was using Ecuador's Wi-Fi. Why couldn't someone just, you know, set up a local access point in Starbucks or whatever's nearest to the embassy and he used that?
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it was. They never let him get on the network. It's like all this time later, oh, you've been using our
Wi-Fi.
You
never bought a coffee.
But put yourself in the position of the Ecuadorian embassy. If Julian Assange was your, you know, acquaintance crashing on your sofa after a heavy night, would you give him the password to your Wi-Fi? I don't think I would.
That's very true.
If I inadvertently did, I'd probably change it after, you know, 3 years at the very least. Right, Julian, that's enough of that.
I think. It's really awkward because I had a huge amount of respect for WikiLeaks, you know, 5 years ago. And
yeah.
Regardless, really, of it's pity that it's become a bit of a personality cult. And I think I'd like to blame Julian Assange for that. I think if he was truly creating a system for whistleblowers and for publishing, you know, transparency, then it shouldn't have had a single point of failure, and certainly shouldn't have been a point of failure to do with a personality or an individual. And that's what makes me suspicious, more than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, WikiLeaks is one of those things where there's many, many bad things about it, but it still remains one of the best platforms for publishing large-scale leaks with, you know, large political cost to them. I think those leaks are a good thing. I think they force transparency in government in whatever way they do. And for all the political issues I have with WikiLeaks and as you say, the personality cult that's gone on behind it, nothing better has come along.
No. I mean, it should be really that, you know, it did happen in some cases where some of the major newspapers would get together and kind of arbitrate over this kind of release, but there needs to be more of an open, I don't know, something that you can trust that isn't ruled by a single person or somebody whose motives you may not be as transparent as the system they're trying to promote.
Yeah.
That would be valuable.
Yeah, we can only hope that another solution comes along. Right, should we move on to the next news item this fortnight? That is that the JS Foundation is now part of the Linux Foundation. So the JavaScript community can now have the wonderful leadership that we do in the Linux community. Do you all feel well led?
I thought that was going to be some good news.
I thought JavaScript was some sort of like ECMA standard. So, I mean, who is the leader of JavaScript? How does that work?
Well, there is a sort of standard bit of JavaScript, but that is very basic in that it's just the core of the programming language and not that much. So all the JavaScript Foundation stuff is... all the loads of chunks of software that use it and all that. It'd be like saying that the Linux is in C and C is a standard, so what does the Linux Foundation do?
Oh, okay. It's not a very clever thing I just said. Okay, again.
So it's about, managing not all JavaScript projects, obviously, but some of the larger ones. I assume trying to push it in new areas in the way that Linux Foundation do with automotive grade Linux and that sort of thing.
I think the Linux Foundation, as we may have said before, has the wrong name.
You mean it should be called the GNU/Linux Foundation?
Yeah, it should actually, for maximum trolling potential.
Obviously, there are issues with the Linux Foundation, but I think it is good to see that maybe not open groups, but collaborative industry groups coming together to support open technologies is fundamentally a good thing. And maybe they could be more open. Maybe they could have better representation of the community. But it's still good for everyone to come together and work together on large projects. I think I might be alone.
I'm just trying to see. I'd like to, I'd like to agree, and I certainly agree with the sentiment. It's just JavaScript and Linux. I understand how they're both, important to one another, and the growth of JavaScript and has particularly been down to Linux, maybe, or LAMP or whatever. But it's just such a weird, another weird partnership from the Linux Foundation. It's just basically play Monopoly with technology and trying to buy Mayfair and Park Lane, and then it's going to hold us all to ransom whenever we would go past it.
Right, should we end up on some good news?
Yes.
The VeraCrypt encryption software is now more secure thanks to an audit by Quark Labs that... I forgot to write this down, but I googled it just before we came on air, so I can quickly scroll back. if I can remember which thing I Googled it in, and almost seamlessly say exactly what. Oh, there we go. Without segueing at all, they found 8 critical security vulnerabilities, 8 medium, oh, sorry, 3 medium vulnerabilities, and 15 low or informational vulnerabilities and concerns. Some, all, or most of these have now been fixed, and you can now use it a little more securely.
That's great. That is great.
I think what's good isn't so much that this, you know, this is an audit of one sort of open source bit of code, but it's a sort of, it's the process. I think security audits are a really good thing to happen in open source software, and this is one on quite an important piece of security software. And the more it can happen, the better.
Yeah, because none basically of us are going to be able to understand the code, so it needs to have stuff like this happening.
Thanks, Ben. Excellent news.
Excellent.
And some actual real positive news items in there to really feel good about. Not least of which Julian Assange having his internet cut off.
Okay, so let's move on to finds of the fortnight. Despite the delays to this podcast starting, I asked the IRC channel just as we started recording, and amazingly, they do have some finds. So huge thanks to the dedicated people who are sitting there chatting about Europe every day. So Devilman, he says this may be a bit too soon, but he points a link to linuxpresentationday.org, linux-presentation-day.org. The one thing I will criticize is that the website, I'm assuming this is a very special day, and you have to get past an image, a small menu, and into the third paragraph to find out when Linux Presentation Day is. Because it keeps referring to it as LPD 2016.2. But it's October the 22nd, and it's an initiative to try and get people doing presentations in their local area about Linux, which is a good thing. There are lots of people doing it, and it's a really good, if you feel like doing a presentation somewhere and you want to get your name on a map, give it a go. You've got a few days after this podcast to try and put something together. After that,
can I just say my find about days of things, and that's that World Standards Day isn't on the same day in every country.
Please tell me you're not trolling.
To be honest, that's something I read on the internet. It could be a lie.
It's like on the it's like I can see what's happened in America. They've taken it's like the 6th or the 4th.
Freedom units.
So there's presentations in Bristol and in Blackpool. Zed Moylan says, reading Nano's manual showed it actually has support for multiple files at once. You can change the direction search, jump to a specific line, or matching open and close. So I think that's a recommendation to read Nano's manual. I've never even looked at it. Tracy C, I found a script that will save and restore window positions for Ubuntu. There's a link there. I'll put the link in the notes. Ian Gogo says, a very interesting GTK3 radio player, which is G Radio by Hacker Felix. And another one, it uses this interesting site, radio-browser.info, which must be for online radio information. And James Olympus says, the Windows 10 market share has fallen in September, and that's the second month in a row, which is fascinating. Who'd have thought?
What's it fallen to?
I don't know. He links to a story on The Register, which I do have open, actually. So StatCounter Global Stats has Windows 10 at 24.42%. So that's down 0.01%. But still, I'd have thought it would be growing at this point in Windows 10.
Yeah, you would. You
would
think so.
Yeah. They're the finds. I think that's about it. So huge thanks to the IRC channel. I will just say on a related note, this is kind of my find, but I was reading through some of the comments to not the previous podcast, but the podcast before, and we must have mentioned PowerShell. Did we say bad things about PowerShell?
We were talking about it, like Microsoft had brought PowerShell out for Linux, I think, and we were trying to work out why you would want PowerShell on Linux or Bash on Windows or vice versa. I forget now, but we did talk about it.
Anyway, Jeffrey Snover left a couple of comments on that podcast, and I think he may be the chief architect or engineer behind PowerShell. So he says, I enjoyed your podcast and thought I would fill you in on the backstory. So he says, we're making PowerShell available on Linux for lots of reasons, including, one, it's a CLI framework for lots of products that want to have Linux support, VMware, SQL, Azure, and others. It provides a uniform cross-platform management infrastructure for management products like System Center and Operations Management Suite. I guess they're Microsoft things. It allows Windows admins the ability to more easily manage their heterogeneous estate. For Linux users, it's just another tool in the tool chest. The benefits of PowerShell are when you're dealing with structured data and APIs, increasingly more and more of the Linux world is being exposed as APIs through REST. That's true. Return structured data through JSON. And he goes on to make much more in-depth point about hypervisors and client servers. And I'm assuming all the kind of stuff that he and the team have developed PowerShell for, links to 5 hours of free training. And I must say, I'm grateful that he's posted and taken the time to comment on PowerShell and probably gives it a different perspective, especially from a Windows user's perspective.
It's an interesting point he makes about being a unified thing, a command line interface for projects sort of moving that already exist on Windows and sort of lowering the bar to create Linux ports of stuff. I hadn't thought of that. It's actually it's a good thing.
Yeah, so if anybody wants to go and check out his comments there on episode 13, I can put a link in the podcast notes because there's a more detailed response beneath that one. So there are kind of community finds. If anyone wants to share one of their finds, I can always go ahead with mine. Not very Linuxy, but a couple of weeks ago now, actually spent like £10 on a bottle of wine, which is something, honestly, we never do.
Wow.
And it had a cork, and it was corked. And honestly, that hasn't happened to me for years. I can't remember the last time I drank a corked bottle of wine. And anyway, it was through a grocery delivery, you know, and so we got the money back. But it seemed a shame to... Okay, I'm not going to drink. Life is too short to drink corked wine. But
but you drank corked wine, didn't you?
In the end, I did, but this is my find. Apparently, I haven't got the link up or anything now. But apparently, scientists have discovered that the compound or whatever it is that's the bacterium that's come off the cork sticks to cellophane, right? So I did decant the bottle of corked wine into a jug that was full of freshly unwrapped cellophane and left it there for about 15 minutes and then carefully removed the cellophane, put it in the bin, and then drank the wine later on the night. And I have to say, it was massively improved. There was still a slight hint of it being corked, but honestly, it was worth drinking as opposed to chucking it away.
Wow.
So, I haven't got the link. I'll put it in the podcast notes, and I haven't researched this before coming online, but it definitely worked. It definitely made a big improvement on the taste of the wine. And really, I don't know if I'd done it again, whether the flavour of the cork, you know, the kind of sweaty men's changing room taste and smell of wine when it's corked, that had mostly gone.
It wasn't just that the taste of cling film overpowered.
No, you couldn't. The cling film was completely transparent. It was, yeah. I still had a cracking headache the next day, so who knows? The toxins and the carcinogens and the cling film made.
And what did you drink in the few hours while you were waiting for this to happen?
I was good. I did that at breakfast, so I was ready for lunch. What else did I find? I think I did have something and I can't think of it right now. So that's my... I did have something else, but I think that's my phone for now. If I remember it, I'll let you know.
Yeah. Mine are slightly more Linux related, but they're also massively stolen off earlier episodes of this podcast. I was in a terminal and as SSH'd into a server... And you know when that just freezes up and it locks, and I was like, oh man, I've got to close the terminal. And but then I was like, hang on, no, I remember that in an earlier episode of the podcast, someone said that there was a way of killing the SSH session that's unresponsive. So I Googled it. And it's, for those of you who vaguely remember it and have forgotten it, as I did, it's enter tilde dot. Not pressed one after the other, not all at the same time. That'll kill an SSH session that's frozen.
Excellent. Brilliant. It's good to have tried it. I've never tried it. But,
it works really well. And the other thing I've known about this, obviously, for a long time, but it's something I've really started using the last couple of weeks, and that's Tmux. Because it was after, like, when we recorded the last podcast, me and Graham were chatting about sort of in command line interfaces and how you sort of use them and that sort of thing. And he was a big Tmux user, and at the time I wasn't. I just used separate terminal windows and alt-tabbed between them. And I thought, I'll just get used to Tmux. I'll sit down and that'll be how I use terminals for the next couple of weeks and see if I get on with it. And I'm really impressed. You know that where you're sort of searching through your different windows to try and remember which one was which session and which server you logged into on which one and, oh, where is it? That's completely gone now. I just know where my terminals are. It's fantastic. It's a bit of a old-fashioned discovery, really. I'm a bit late to the party on this one.
It's so good that actually one of us has written about Tmux in the next issue of Linux Voice. So, yeah.
I haven't even read that. Maybe that'll make me an even better Tmux user.
Oh, yeah.
It is. I mean, I use it. I have like 6 terminals open via Tmux, and I use a load of plugins for accessing GitHub. And, you know, it's just a really great system and integrates so well with Vim as well. If you happen to use Vim at the same time, you know, things like save and restore and resume, and really works well.
You're too lazy to write an initd script for your server, just to run it in a Tmux session. I've got a couple more finds, actually. One, this isn't really a find, it's just a little bit of a rant. I've spent all day today trying to fix an SE Linux bug, and it's annoying. It's so annoying. I assume it's not an actual bug in SE Linux. I assume it's a bug in my permissions thing, but it's so opaque trying to work out what's going on. It just won't work, and just want to throw the thing out the window. And what I want to do is just disable SE Linux across the whole thing, but that's probably not the best idea. Although it's so tempting when that's one little command just makes everything work and it all goes away and you don't have to worry about it. And no one will notice, because whoever checks that SE Linux is running.
Security shouldn't be complicated, should it? Because, that's the problem with things like SE Linux. I understand that they solve a complicated problem, but 99% of people are just going to turn it off, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, it doesn't matter how good your lock is if you put the key under the lock the door.
Yeah,
just turn off SE Linux, chmod 777 everything, and your problems just go away. It's wonderful.
I have that problem whenever I'm editing files on a website or something like that. I'll often just change own everything and change mod everything.
One slightly more useful finder this fortnight is Pi-hole. It's an ad block thingy for the Raspberry Pi, where if you've got a Pi running as a server in your house, put Pi-hole on it. It will set up a DNS server that just bins all advertising domains, set up to be a DNS server. And if you've got a router that allows you to set DNS servers at that level, just set it up on your router, and that will just give you advertisement-free browsing from the whole of that network.
Yeah, I was looking into this recently, and I, as I understand it, it's so good because none of your requests even get through to the advertising sites. Everything is filtered out purely at your local network level. Yeah, so ads.foobar.com, not even a single data packet gets out to it, because your Pi just redirects it to localhost or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how this one does, but usually they return just an empty image, just a blank image.
Okay. That'll probably help some sites to work, yeah.
Yeah, and it's faster than returning 404s a lot of the time, or just dropping it, because then your browser's waiting for a response and it gets upset.
Of course, yeah.
But you can also have little graphs with Pi-hole about how much you've blocked and which advertisers you've blocked them from and whatnot. And I really have gone both ways on advertising on the internet, because on the one hand, I do think it's important for content producers to be able to make money off content. You know, we all enjoy it, we read it, and it's, you know, it's not a free service. They have to pay hosting, they have to pay writers, etc., etc. But it's just taking the mickey at the moment, the advertising on the web. It just kills your browser and your battery life on mobile, and it's horrible.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben.
Shall I go next?
Go for it, Mike.
Yeah, I discovered MicroG at microg.org. And this is, as the site describes, a free as in freedom re-implementation of Google's proprietary Android user space apps and libraries. And the website then goes on to say, the Linux open source mobile operating system, the Linux-based open source mobile operating system Android is not only the most popular mobile operating system in the world, it's also on the way to becoming a proprietary operating system. How is that? While the core operating system is still released as part of the Android open source project, the majority of core apps are not. It gets even worse. More and more libraries and APIs are only available on phones that run various Google apps pre-installed, effectively locking third-party apps into the Google ecosystem. For this reason, Android is called a look but don't touch kind of open. So I myself, and I'm not using this yet. I only discovered it a few days ago, but I was looking around curious about this idea, because I've got a old Samsung S3 mini phone. I could upgrade at some point, but I just can't be bothered. But I'd like to replace it with proper, fully free, open source operating system at some point. This looks like good first steps that, you know, you tell people, like, oh yeah, I run Linux. And like, what's that? And so, oh, it's similar to what you run on your phone. Android is sort of Linux-based. But as we've seen, more and more bits of Linux of Android are becoming less and less free and open source. So good luck to these guys. They're doing step by step. They've got a replacement for the Google Play services, the proxy Maps API. They're working on a replacement for the store and so forth. It'll probably take a while, but kudos to them, and I hope it works.
Awesome. That does sound brilliant. Actually, I have to have a look. It's a very ambitious idea.
Is it my turn?
Yeah, if very you good. Like.
Well, I almost uniquely this month, I have this fortnight rather, I have a Linux related find, and that is, I like Ben said, you know, that he's behind the curve a wee bit. I'm hanging way back in 2004 because I've just discovered Thunderbird, the email client. Now, when I first installed Linux, I tried Firefox, LibreOffice, OpenOffice, etc., and then installed this thing called Thunderbird, so it can do all of your emails. And the first thing it asked me for was a POP server or IMAP server, and I didn't have a clue what that was, so I just deleted it and went back to using Gmail. But now I've got I've got my own domain, my own web server, and I needed something to test it out on. So I installed Thunderbird, and it just feels like being a proper grown up. It feels like I've really leveled up. You know, I've jumped on that mushroom, and I'm now twice as big. It's just fantastic. But the weird thing is, there is nothing remarkable about Thunderbird at all. Like, there's nothing strange, there's nothing to frighten the horses. There's no reason for any, you know, if any business that is paying money for a proprietary email client, they just don't need to be, because it's cross-platform and it just works. And that's what email is, just the definitive just works technology. It's so, you know, technically it's obsolete, it's rubbish, no one likes it, and yet we still keep using it. It's the ideal thing to just commoditize it out and make it free, and because it just works, even though we don't really like it. So there we go. So I'm a real grown up now.
I haven't used a proper email client in probably 10 years. What is it that's better about it than your webmail?
I don't know. I think
didn't
I,
your internet connection go down before, Ben? That might be one answer. Local mail.
It's still stuff for you on your desktop, your old emails. But I also I like the control that it gives you about being able to organize things into different folders. The interface is just a bit more intuitive for me. Like Google Mail, I've been using for about 10 years, but I still just don't get it. I don't get how it works, and it feels weird that somebody else, some proprietary. No, it's not even that they're proprietary, it's just that they're massive and they've got all the money in the world. That makes me feel a bit weird about my stuff passing through their stuff.
Yeah. And I use an email client as well. I feel
so much happier now. It's great.
With Roundcube is pretty good, but I mean, does search work for you with Roundcube?
The search does, if you sort of learn its quirks.
I can rarely get it to find like content of messages when the messages are visible on the screen. If that was from a message a year ago, I think it's impossible, at least when I've used it.
Yeah, you just have to change the little drop-down thing to say search the content.
Yeah, I've done that.
Yeah, that's always worked for me. Oh. Either that or just grep vast spool.
Old school Ben, rocking it, awesome.
I like desktop integration with email apps as well, especially with KDE. It's probably the same with Unity and GNOME as well, but that always seems much more streamlined. You can write an email to someone just by starting to type their name in the desktop, that kind of stuff.
Well, that sounds like all of the finds of the fortnight are over. So it's time now for our halfway reminder, which, as tradition dictates, is it's almost an hour through the podcast. Still to come, we have Vocalize Your Neurons, and Mike's nodding, which means that there are neurons this time. Wonderful. And we have the voice of the minority. So, Mike, over to you.
Excellent. Thanks, Andrew. Over here in Germany, we have a neuron to report, and it's from Kenny, who says, in the spirit of Brexit, writes it like break. Don't worry, this isn't about Brexit or Brexit.
That's how all good internet comments start, in the spirit of Brexit.
In the spirit of Brexit, isn't it time Linux took back control of file sharing? Samba, while extremely useful for interconnecting with other operating systems, can give the ordinary bloke or bloke-esque a mental hernia, especially when all you want is simple home network file sharing with basic yes or no access permissions. In the olden days, I would sit with the smb.conf file for a few hours over a coffee, have a bit of a to and fro with it, but lately I haven't had the time and generally default to copy-pasting someone else's set of bash commands, after which I have often had a fright when a friend on a MacBook, whom I've given access to my wireless network, can see straight into my computer's yikes. Could the solution for Linux to Linux to Android be KDE Connect? If this could be expanded to cover all Linux devices with some added optional restrictions so you could keep some folders private, we could do file sharing and notification sharing and all the other things that KDE Connect does or will do by simply pairing devices as we see fit. We might even see versions of KDE Connect developed for other lesser platforms. Would this be a brilliant solution, or are my neurons firing in the wrong direction? Thanks, Kenny, for that. To be honest, I don't know. I've never used KDE Connect. Graham, KDE, do you have Connect, any thoughts on this?
I use KDE Connect every day. It's like basically you add your it's KDE Connect as an app on your phone. It's in F-Droid and it's on Google Play Store, and you install it on your desktop, and then any notifications you get on your phone appear on your desktop, and you can access phone calls and messages and the file system on the phone just through, as long as you're connected to the same access points. Brilliant.
So it's file sharing made for dummies. It's like super simple.
Yeah.
Or simple in Linux terms.
I don't get great performance out of it for file transfers. I'll nearly always plug in the phone and do it over MTP or something. But it's really good for convenience.
So, yeah, thanks, Kenny. If anybody else has neurons to send, then email mike@linuxvoice.com.
My file sharing solution is incredibly lazy, but it works quite well. If you have a terminal in the folder you want to share, and you just type Python space dash simple HTTP server with caps in the appropriate places. It will open a HTTP server on port 8000, I think, and just share that folder. But then I do disable SE Linux and Schmod 777 everything, so you may not want to take my advice for networking.
Those are a few extra bullet points in those instructions. Yeah, disable all security on your operating system.
That brings us skidding in an uncontrolled slide before the invention of ABS brakes to our final section, which is voice of the minority.
The minorities. And
it's minorities. It's entirely our fault that we don't have a voice of the masses, because we were just too lame to get one sorted in time.
Drinking wine.
So drinking corked wine in a wine glass packed full of cellophane, because we're just so desperate for our alcohol fix. Yes. And we asked ourselves and each other about KDE. Now, KDE, it's 20 years old this week.
25, I think.
No, it's 20 years
old. Okay, sorry, Andrew.
Yes, which basically blows out of the water my premise that this was all going to be on your shoulders, Graham, given that you're the only KDE fan here.
I think,
Even though the other three of us hate KDE and all that it stands for and everyone who uses it, we can at least acknowledge that it has given us some non-rubbish things. For example, Caligra and Critter and the Qt toolkit and has provided a spur to innovation for GNOME. However, it's also really rubbish. So let's between the four of us, let's try and reconcile the awesome positivity that KDE has brought to the free software world and also the rubbishness that it's brought with it. Graham, despite being tragically ill-informed about how old KDE actually is, maybe you should kick us off.
Well, I think KDE is not rubbish. It's absolutely brilliant.
And thanks, sir. Thanks, Graham.
And I'll tell you why. It's a desktop like no other. It's a power user. It's like the shell for your screen, basically. You can do anything you want. You don't have to be stereotyped or typecast into using your computer in a certain way. It looks awesome. It performs brilliantly. For example, I installed a script just this week for enabling a windowless mode and created three columns on my desktop for creating three different sections of the screen. Plasma 5.8 is the strongest release ever, and it's finally surpassed what KDE 4.x used to be. There's so many good things about it. Honestly, it's the only desk. I really don't see people who use their computers and they turn them on and they use Unity and they use GNOME, fine. They do. The computers serve a purpose for them. I understand that. It's useful. I can open up GNOME and I can open up Unity and I use my computer in that way, and I do. But if you really want to start enjoying your computer, KDE gives you all the flexibility, all of the integration. It looks awesome. It performs brilliantly. And it's being developed by people who listen to their users. It's great. And I've used it, you know, for a large part of those 20 years, it feels. And did you see that you can somebody, I don't know how they did it, but they kind of ported KDE1 to use the latest Qt libraries, and you can run KDE1, remind yourself how far things have changed.
Yeah, we were talking about that while you were still having internet troubles, actually, before we started recording. But what we really, the conclusion we came to is why on earth would you want to do this?
Well, we run Amigas and Commodore 60. Well, I do, and yes. And it is quite interesting.
Me and you, Graham.
I think it is pure nostalgia. I'd never do it for anything more than just to remind myself how far we've come. But honestly, from an objective perspective, I would like to know why the hate. What's wrong with KDE?
I don't hate it. I just find.
I thought you said you hated it.
And well, we all hate it, apparently.
We all hate it. All right then, yeah, I do hate it. I hate it because all the times that I was learning, all the times that I was forced to learn how to use a computer in those IT lessons at school in 1992, sat down, you will do this, you will do that, when the computer isn't a means to an end. The computer becomes the end itself. And that's not what computers are for. They're enablers. They shouldn't be the objective. They're not the pinnacle. They're there to help you get to the peak. The lesson was always how to do stuff, how to get from A to B, how to drag things over here to and rename stuff. And I've learned that and I've put that behind me now. But every time I pick up KDE, it feels like I have to do that all over again. I feel like I can't just open a text file and start writing in it, or open a web browser or move, copy and paste something to somewhere else. It feels like it's trying to force its own unintuitive ways on me. And that's why I hate it, because it just wants to interfere with and mess with my thought processes. And it makes the act of using a computer a trial rather than something neutral, which is what it should be. I don't find any joy in using a computer. It is just a tool. It's a hammer or a chisel. But KDE is a chisel that's like a really weirdly shaped chisel that you can't grip unless you do some sort of like weird, you know, Mason's initiative handshake to get hold of it. And
I understand what you're saying. Yeah, I think it's a good point. I think, you know, in a lot of ways, that's what tablets have become. Touch interfaces have kind of made computers that become computers that you just turn on and you do the thing that you want to do with them and you turn them off. And I think it's a bit like some people have tidy desks and some people have messy desks. And, you know, some people use computers in one way and other people use computers in another. And I think KDE definitely falls into that other category. And I wouldn't want you to take it away from me for anything. I have to secretly use it in crowded rooms now.
But, you know, you could also argue with this, that say, well, all right, Andrew's saying it'd take him a while to get used to this weird new chisel grip. But maybe if he did, he would suddenly become way more productive. You look at text editors like Emacs and Vim, they're absolutely horrible at the start. And yet, when you get into them, you know, you could no way go back to WordPad or Notepad or Nano or something like that. So, you know, from my perspective, I obviously don't hate KDE. I think KDE is pretty cool. I don't use it on a day-to-day basis myself. I find it insanely configurable, hateful, powerful desktop. I like minimalism. But if I wanted maximum configurability and a lot of integration between the different apps, I would use KDE.
Well, the thing is, sorry, Ben, go for it.
Yeah, you said it was like Emacs or Vi, but Emacs and Vi have been like they are now for the past 40 odd years. If you could use it 40 years ago, you could use it now. That's an investment in learning. It's going to pay off in the long run. KDE is going to be like it is now for.
No, it's fundamentally the same.
That's the opposite of KDE.
No. The shortcuts.
They're going to pull the rug out from under you in the next 2 or 3 years and reinvent paradigms and all sorts of stuff.
Maybe from a visual perspective, but no, it's actually been the same for a long time. The shortcuts are the same. The way that you manipulate Windows is exactly the same. And I even use activities now, and I can navigate up and down. You see, you just wouldn't use a computer like this, I know. But I have four desktops one activity, and I have another four desktops in another, and it's like two-dimensional space. I can move left and right through activities that have similar tasks, and each activity is actually just a window full of consoles or TMUX sessions. There's nothing in KDE actually Dolphin, the file manager, is absolutely brilliant, the way that you can split up multiple views and access all kinds of remote sites. But and the K launcher as well, the fact that you can launch applications, chat to people, send emails, find files. It's just I use a toolbar down the left, just like on Unity and GNOME. So it's not even like that. The window manager, the integration, the fact that it doesn't get in your way, and the fact that it's very configurable are the reasons why I like it.
Yeah, I think my general use of computers has gone from complex to simple. When I first started using Linux, it was KDE, probably KDE 3, maybe KDE 2, I can't remember, way back when in the early 2000s, and then switched to GNOME, sort of not too much longer after Ubuntu came out. And it sort of, I went from using virtual desktops and all this, and I sort of gradually cut down the number of virtual desktops back when you had all stuff on the desktops doing things. What were they called? Karamba or whatever it was. And it's sort of, gradually simplified everything down. And now I use a single desktop, and I don't miss any of it. I like having a simple interface.
How do you fit like a browser and the console on the same screen?
Tab between them when I need to.
How many tabs have you got open on your browser?
Quite a lot often.
I can't. My brain just can't handle more than 10 or 12 tabs on a browser on one screen. I can put a browser with different set of tabs on a different screen, a different virtual desktop. And it's the same with console sessions.
I can't handle different, like, if I have two browser sessions open, I never keep the tabs ordered, if that makes sense. I just end up with the wrong tabs in the wrong browser.
I try and keep mine separate. In fact, I use Chrome and I use Firefox at the same time for different things as well, and on different virtual desktops.
Yeah.
I think my fundamental problem is I'm massively disorganized. So if you give me more stuff, I just make more chaos.
I just don't think I've got the mental capacity. Honestly, it's quite seriously, I'm kind of a tidy desk person. I don't think I've got the mental capacity to be able to concentrate on things when there's all kinds of distraction. I actually see KDE as being able to organize distraction into small components that I can then work from.
You see, I'm a messy desk person, and I like to get all my mess into one small place where I can find it. Maybe this is the split.
I don't think I've got the mental ability to shuffle a busy desk. That's the truth. I just can't think. I just go mad. I forget everything. Like, I forgot the found earlier on. I remembered what my find was. And this is really crazy because I should have known this years ago. But did you know that you can right-click on a window and hold Alt down, or control, right click, and it resizes the window?
Hang on, in KDE?
Yeah, well, I think it must be universal, but yeah, I am just doing it in KDE.
I know, like, Alt and left click lets you move one around.
Yeah, so I use Alt and left click all the time, and I didn't.
Yeah, I use that.
And right click allows you to resize the window.
I've never tried that in good old XFCE, my home.
Well,
doesn't work in Unity.
Well, I've since learning this, and it may just be a KDE thing, I don't know, I use it all the time. And it seems insane now to go back to the corner or the edge of a window to try and resize it.
To grab onto that little three-pixel handle.
That tiny little target that you always
just miss. Right-click and move left or right, and it expands up or down. And if you've got KDE's awesome kind of sticky borders and sticky window borders and the way that you can divide a screen into halves or quarters or thirds, it's great.
That is awesome if you know that. But if you don't know that, how would you get to know that? I remember when the first time maybe the second or third time I installed Linux, I ended up extending a window too far, and there was a button that I had to click to accept something or other, and that was off the screen, and I just couldn't scroll it back up, and by clicking on things, I just couldn't work out how to get this up. And I think either you or Paul said to me, you hold down Alt and left click, and then you can drag the whole thing up.
That was deliberate, Andrew. That was a deliberate test of geekiness. But
there was no way for me to discover that. Yeah. There was no way to work that out.
By the way, it's Alt and middle button on Unity, and there is a way of discovering it if you hold down Windows key for a couple of seconds.
Why would I hold down the Windows key?
Well, that's the only thing you need to know. If you know that you have to hold down the Windows key, that brings up all the shortcuts.
But you're Linux users. We don't have Windows keys.
I do think.
Well, the meta key. Then.
I've never owned a machine with a Windows key, I don't think.
The Mac's got an equivalent of it, hasn't it?
The equivalent of a Windows key? I've got no idea.
Yeah, like a Mac.
It's even more confusing on a Mac. It's got like two keys. It's got the Option key and the Apple key.
Well, anyway, even if I had a Windows machine now, I would never know to press the Windows key. If I've got a Windows machine and I've installed Linux, why would I ever want to press the Windows key? Doesn't make any sense.
Cool stuff, like it allows you to change the window.
But how do you know it does cool stuff? You've got no idea it does cool stuff.
Because actually, when you first boot up Unity, you get a little message with that option.
Which you then dismiss.
But it says on it,
press all you have to do is look on Facebook
to get it back. It's literally the only thing you need to know on Unity is press and hold the Windows key, and anyway, then you find everything.
I've looked over Graham's shoulder while he's been working in KDE, and it's like watching Tom Cruise in Minority Report, just throwing stuff around and magnifying. Enhance. 2,000%.
Is that why all the hate for KDE? You're afraid that someone's going to come and get you for a crime you haven't yet committed?
I'm afraid that Graham Morrison is going to be the new Jack Reacher, and he's going to come and get me. Yeah.
I think you raise a very good point. I think there are a lot of problems with KDE. Communication and the way that the project is, the transparency of the project are two big parts of it. You can't tell from one release to the other what comes out, what's new and how to use it. Never have been able to.
But you've got to give credit to them for thinking ahead. If we, you know, going back to celebrating their 20 years, at timeline.kde.org, they have a really good timeline with different, you know, short pictures of different things that have happened, not only through KDE's history, but going back before, like when did free software start? What, you know, Stallman's original ideas. But one thing I read was that in 1997, KDE EV, so the non-profit that represents the KDE community financially and legally, was founded in Tübingen in Germany in 1997. Now, KDE itself only really started in 1996, I think. I started using Linux in 1996 myself, and I remember seeing screenshots and trying early versions of KDE 1, you know, the first proper like unifying desktop, and I had no idea that they were thinking that early on, let's get the nonprofit set up, you know, which helps with organizing donations, paying people to do things, you know, especially in a country like Germany where most of the early hackers were. It's a really good idea to get this set up, get this structure, and to build up a community like the LibreOffice guys did later. And I had no idea. I thought that would have been like 10 years later, but they did it so early on. Good on them.
Right, that's all credit to our European friends who are no longer our friends. Go away, Europeans. We don't like you anymore.
Never did
but like thanks. thanks to the KDE people for making it an independent legal entity so that it can thrive and provide a spur, a competitor to innovation for decent desktops such as GNOME that usual normal people use.
Which came about because of the Qt licensing issue at the time.
Well, it did, exactly, yeah. You know, if somebody does something... That's a Ken Dodd sketch, isn't it? The best way to find out what time it is to lean out the window and say, who's that banging a drum at 4 o'clock? No, sorry, other way around. The best way to find out what time it is to bang a drum in the middle of the night, and then someone will lean out the window and say, why are you banging that drum at 4 o'clock in the morning? KDE is the banging drum. Doesn't matter anymore. It's time to wrap this podcast up. If you like the sound of this but would prefer it in a paper or Electron based version with most of the typos cleaned up and not with such gibberish, you can obtain such a thing by going to shop.linuxvoice.com and getting either a paper or a PDF version of our magazine. We thank you very much for doing so, because we put an awful lot of effort into doing it, and it's just wonderful to think of people around the world reading our words. We will see you in... We will hear you. No, you will hear us in two weeks or so in the latest podcast, and until then, we'll be off. I'm going to go and eat my dinner, I think. So bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ciao. It's such a nice